studying the stories of the Zen ancestors in the Denko Roku, the record of transmitting the light, compiled by Keizan Zenji, the fourth generation Soto teacher in Japan after Dogen. Before getting into the Denko Roku, I just thought a little bit about Keizan, who's about to give his commentary now, to get to know him a little bit. There's this book called Keizan Study Material, compiled by my friend Charlie Picorni. It's like almost like a 200-page book of like everything in English about Keizan and his life. You know, there's not nearly as much written about Keizan as Dogen, but he found quite a bit. So this is actually Francis Cook here. A little bit about Keizan. He was born right near Eheiji. So, and all his early years of practice were right around the same province as Dogen's Eheiji Monastery. So I think that was part of what happens after a few generations of Zen in a country is that you don't have to travel as far to practice Zen. You know, I mean, it was kind of amazing that this brand new Zen movement, where there wasn't a lot of Zen yet, but the center of Soto Zen was right there at Eheiji, and so before that people were going off to China to learn and practice Zen, and he never went to China, he never left that area of Japan even. While still a boy, he became a student of the third ancestor, Tetsu Gikai, who was abbot of Eheiji at that time. And apparently at the age of 12, he received the precepts from the former abbot, the second ancestor, Koun Ejo. So these are our ancestors after Dogen. And at the age of 17, he left Eheiji to travel to a bunch of different monasteries to meet various teachers and be tested by them, a practice that went back hundreds of years in China. He went to Hokyoji, which still is a practicing temple near Eheiji, where the abbot was Jakuen, a Chinese monk who came back from China with Dogen, or maybe after Dogen, but to practice with Dogen in Japan, which is kind of unusual. It says something about Dogen that someone followed him back. So Jakuen at Hokyoji made Keizan the Ino, a high honor indeed, since the position of Ino is always reserved for monks who had trained a long time and were recognized as being proficient. Our two current Inos are here in Sesshin. Nanette is just entered as the new co-Ino. So I wanted to include that part. The Ino is a high honor for great practitioners since ancient times.
The hearts of Inos.
So he was, you know, there for a while, but didn't stay that long, and then went on to other places. The story gets kind of complex. This is a maybe briefer version, but I thought I maybe brought this up last year, but I think it's something kind of interesting about it. About the third generation schism, which was, I think, had an impact on Kazan's life. This is the Roaring Stream. Nelson Foster. Conventional Soto histories speak of a schism in the school's third generation centering on Tetsu Gikai, the teacher from whom Keizan would later receive Dogen's robe and transmission. The term schism seems too strong in light of current research, but apparently disciples of another third generation teacher, 12 years senior to Gikai, felt he had been slighted by Gikai or wrongly passed over for the abbacy, and they succeeded in making his tenure at Eheiji so uncomfortable that Gikai stepped down after fewer than 5 years. So interesting, I think, because these are the great founders of Soto Zen in Japan. And they have political struggles in their temple. Maybe with Dogen, he just founded the place. It was not really an issue. The first generation may be the easiest, right? It's just a great celebration that there's a new Zen practice place and kind of teaching. But then it has to keep getting passed along. So difficult. How do you do this? So there were apparently these two factions who each of them wanted different abbots. And other versions of the story that I read is that Gikai was kicked out. But this is maybe more reasonable. They just made his tenure so uncomfortable that he left on his own. Four decades later, when Keizan himself missed appointment to the abbot seat at Eheiji, he set his sights on founding another great monastery farther to the north. These events created factional wrangling for centuries to come, but also brought a broadening of the Soto base that has made it the largest of the Japanese Zen schools by far. So you never know. Are results good or bad, right? Things spread out, and maybe if they were all like, it's all about Eheiji, we all that's all we have to keep going, then it would have just maybe like fizzled out or something. But for maybe uncomfortable reasons, Tetsu Gikai left, but then kind of spread Zen around the country a little bit more. And as Eheiji's principal sponsor, the Hatano family had effectively controlled the naming of its abbots. Seems like this is how things worked in those days, is it was all about the lay supporters of these temples who had a lot of money and basically funded the monasteries, and they had a lot of control over what happened there. Yeah. I think it's still somewhat like that in Japan, depending on the place. Maybe the Rinzai sub-temples of the big monasteries are often like wealthy family, generations of wealthy families keep kind of controlling them and choosing the abbots and so on. Among Keizan's initial steps in developing his new monastery, Yokoji, was ensuring its freedom from such patron interference. In 1317, his backers in this enterprise gave him a commitment in writing, allowing him extraordinary latitude. And this letter gets quoted various places. It's a little bit extreme how much latitude he's kind of, some say, he's demanding from them because he's seen this trouble. But I think they were also very devoted to Kazan. It was I think, wealthy statesman, and his wife, whose name was Mokufu Sonin, Acharya Mokufu Sonin, who later got ordained with Kazan, and according to most records, became a Dharma successor of Kazan. Dogen also had women students. Kazan had women students, and it seems like his main woman successor was Mokufu Sonin. It's, for those who don't know, we chant these women ancestors in the morning, and we chant her name. Yeah.
Was it not the practice then, when you received transmission, to go and start a new temple?
I think that often was. It's not so clear exactly, but it seemed like some would have to stay in the temples that were already there, and the more successors there were, the more they spread out. And these are like bigger monasteries, you know. Usually, I don't know. There weren't these small temples yet, I think, in those days like there are now. Shortly thereafter, I think there maybe were, where there would just be like an abbot of a smaller town temple, and they would generally have one successor, and then it would just get passed along like that. That's how it is generally in modern Japan. So it makes it kind of easier. Yes? Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if we know all the details, but I can see if I could find this other part where Kazan was a great supporter of women practitioners. He was very close to his mother, who I don't think was a nun, but she was a very devout practitioner. And so he later set up a kind of like a hermitage for his mother at the temple, at the monastery. And when Mokufu Sonin, and I think her husband got ordained as a monk too, later also, but we don't know as much about him. I think he was very close with Mokufu Sonin, and later she had a kind of like, it seemed like a kind of hermitage or a small women's, I don't know if it was a whole community, but like I think they call it like a sanctuary on the temple grounds, just for her. So still all at the same place because maybe they had a lot of land. So, yeah. I'll check it out. If she actually became an abbot at another place at some point. Yeah. Well, there definitely were. At that time, I don't know if she was. But as the generations went on, definitely. And there's in current Japan, it's definitely a minority, but there are, and I think that there's one Soto Zen women's training monastery in Japan. There aren't that many training monasteries. There's thousands of small temples, and maybe like 15 or so bigger monasteries, like we might think of like Tassajara. There's not so many. Sojiji, Meiheiji, and others. And one of them, which is still, you know, if there's only 15, one of them is not that few, is a very thriving women's, just women. And several Americans have gone to practice there. This commitment in writing that Kazan got from them, from Mokufu Sonin and her husband. Quote, We will take absolutely no notice whether the temple thrives or decays. The donors are saying this. We are not concerned whether the master keeps the precepts or breaks them. Likewise, we will not interfere if he gives away the land to his wife, a child, a relative. This was when monks couldn't marry anyway. But if he wants to get married and give it to his wife, it's okay. Or even to outcasts and beggars. 2 years later, they signed another version of this pledge, expanded to guarantee that the abbacy of Yokoji would always remain in the hands of Keizan's Dharma heirs, passing in order of priestly seniority from one person to the next. And there was something interesting about, Keizan had a bunch of Dharma heirs, so he said, his direct successors, he said, maybe he didn't want to single any of them out, so he said, they'll each serve a term in order of seniority. So we don't know what happened after they were abbots, if they stayed on practicing there or what. Many different models for how to do these things. The succession squabbles at Eheji and elsewhere gave Keizan all the motivation he needed to lock up the Yokoji abbacy in this manner. In addition to preventing a patron from installing a representative of a rival line, even a Rinzai teacher, as it happened at another temple, it dramatically reduced the chances of his descendants falling into discord. Maybe that's part of it, is like, let's keep it all in the same, we all kind of know each other and we're going along with this, and so we're used to the style. It'll make less discord. Like I read elsewhere that eventually this became like, there were these rival factions of Eheji and Sojiji, which later became the two, are currently the two head Soto monasteries in Japan. Kind of equal status of monasteries. But there was all this problem for centuries between these two factions, and they did things a little differently. And they had great controversy and arguments over, for example, how you wear the okesa. Kind of rogue. And it's still, I just read that today, actually. And I thought, how interesting, because they still, there's a Eheji and Sojiji style. The Sojiji, and there's in America, there's these two streams now. And Sojiji, this corner of the okesa doesn't go over the shoulder. It kind of like tucks in the front. So like Jiyu Kennet Roshi practiced at Sojiji, so her Shasta Abbey and that whole lineage tucks their okesa in front. And Maizumi Roshi's lineage too. So little things become important in Zen, or into details. Yes. Okay, so we say at ordination as kind of like a novice priest, ordination into the priesthood, it's a black okesa. And then at Dharma transmission, succeeding to one's teacher and the lineage is passed on, then one receives a brown okesa. And then in Japan, it gets much more complicated than that. There's all these kind of like ranks and things with different colors. It's kind of absurd. And they get more and more like fancy brocade and so on. And So Dharma transmission is the beginning of this incredibly complicated mass of ecclesiastical ranking in modern Soto Zen in Japan. We don't have this in America. Thank goodness. And it has to do basically time spent in monasteries and in universities. So there's like a kind of like education, it's all about education and training, and so on. But this is that's a bunch of, like, you know, stories about worldly matters in Zen tradition. Yes. Is there a particular reason for these particular colors? Probably. I've wondered sometimes too. Is that, you know, tried to research a little bit. Like, I think brown is the usual color for Buddhist monks. In fact, okesa, O is like an honorific, and the word kesa is the transliteration of the Sanskrit word kashaya. And kashaya means like ochre color. So it literally means that. And I think most Buddhist countries have some version. And that does go back to the Buddha's time where they're like, they gather the scraps. That's why it's a patched robe made of these pieces. They gather these scraps, usually white, and then they dye them in this kind of like mixed color that was the color of the plants. When I visited Thailand, they still do this like that. I think it's called jackfruit tree. Maybe we don't have in America, but you boil the jackfruit in water, and it makes this murky brownish color, and they dye the robes in that. So black, I think it could have had to do with something just about like how fabric was made and dyes that were available in China, where it started. And of course, these robes are black. And I think we were talking this morning about black is kind of the color of like the ultimate, like where you can't distinguish anything in the dark. So it's kind of like the vast inconceivability is kind of represented by black. So it might have to do with that. And there's places where it says Dogen's okesa was like bluish black, actually. So, but exactly how that all happened, and there's different how its colors switched and stuff, I haven't heard any definitive thing. So Kazan, this is the record of all these awakening stories. Kazan, it's nice to know how he realized the way, because it says something about him too. Yeah. One morning, he was listening to Tetsu Gikai's lecture in the Dharma Hall, and Tetsu Gikai brought up the koan, "Ordinary mind is the way." One time in the old days, Zhaozhou asked, "What's the way?" And Nan Chuan said, "Ordinary mind is the way." And they went on to discuss that, like, well, should I direct myself towards it? Well, if you direct yourself towards it, you go astray from it. Well, then should I just forget about it? If you ignore it, then you miss it. So this kind of dialogue in which Zhaozhou realized something. So Tetsu Gikai was talking about a Chinese Zen koan, as has been done since these early days of Zen in Japan. And he brought up, "Ordinary mind is the way." And Kazan, when he heard that phrase, or he heard his teacher talking about it, he had some insight, something open for him. He had some awakening. And he immediately declared, "I got it." And Tetsu Gikai questioned him, saying, "What? What did you realize?" And Kazan said, "Black balls zipping through the dark night." Something like that. So here it is again. Black on black. You know, jet black balls plummeting through the black night. So something very dynamic happening, but you can't see a thing. Like black. That's how he expressed his insight into ordinary mind is the way. Agikai questioned him further, still not clear, explaining further. And Keizan said, at tea time, I drink tea. At lunchtime, I eat rice. So we've already touched on this kind of thing, like in this morning's story, we had this verse of Dayan, who we're talking about, where he says, if you release a black bird at night, it flies clothed in snow. So first, so it's like, ordinary mind is like a black bird at night, or like a black ball, plummeting through black space, almost identical. And then, but that is like flying coated with white snow, where you can, all the distinctions are apparent. So black balls running through the black night. Well, explain further. Okay, to explain further, at the time of tea, I drink tea, and at lunchtime, I have rice. That's like clothed in snow. That's like ordinary activities that you can see. At tea time, you drink the tea, and at lunchtime, you eat the rice. Ordinary activities, like this statue of Manjushri was made by Sally. So, this is kind of, I think, helpful to just hear this kind of language over and over, because it keeps appearing in these stories, almost like these two sides, right? Of like, ordinary mind is this ultimate inconceivable vastness, expressed kind of poetically. Black bird singing in the dead of night. And if we say further, what is that? Well, it's just like this painting, or having some tea and rice. We don't want to get stuck in either side. It's actually having tea and rice is an inconceivable, dark event. And an inconceivable dark event takes the form of ordinary activity. There's a, in one of modern Japan, they have this kind of like Soto Zen, Soto Shu, the Soto School publishes a kind of newsletter. Maybe they stopped doing this, but every episode they'd have these cartoons that were like episodes from the life of Dogen and Keizan. So this is a cartoon version of the story. It's like some episode in the longer. Here's Gikai saying, you must, and they're in Dokusan, in a room here, sitting face to face. You must continue your training. Yes, master. And then here's Gikai teaching the assembly in the Dharma Hall. In Zen, there is a well-known teaching that ordinary mind is the way. And here's Gikai, like, facing the assembly. Does anyone understand this? Is there anyone here who understands this? In the audience. I do, Master. You do? Do you? Go ahead and speak. It's like a black pearl darting through pitch black darkness. Here he is saying, can you say that a little more plainly in this translation? Using another expression. When drinking tea, I drink tea gratefully. When eating, I eat with gratitude. That's another nice little twist on it too. He's speaking in the back and other people are turning around and looking at him. This Kazan. We celebrated his memorial the other day. And I just read today in some of these historical things that, it was Monday. We did a Dogen and Kazan memorial, so we had pictures of Dogen and Kazan, and they have the same Memorial Day. And I read that this was very recent. This was like, relatively speaking, it was like the 1800s, so many, many centuries after Kazan's life, that Soto school started doing this kind of co-memorial. Before that, it was all just Dogen, and I think that like all the schools, all the temples of the school didn't even celebrate Kazan's memorial, or it was a more minor thing. So then to combine them into one day and kind of like equalize them was a, based on lots of politics too, I think. And relatively recent. Now they're called the father and mother of Soto Zen sometimes. And also, I heard that this Denko Roku, along with Dogen's Shobo Genzo, that only those two texts are considered the two jewels of the Soto Zen tradition. So, to celebrate that here, we have an annual Genzo-e Sesshin on the Shobo Genzo and a Denko-e Sesshin on the Denko Roku. But both of these great masterworks were basically like hidden away in like temple libraries for many centuries. They were like written and transcribed at the time of Dogen and Kazan, but then they went kind of underground. And they're these amazing writings, especially the Shobo Genzo, which now considered one of the greatest literary masterpieces in all of Japan, even outside of Buddhism. So it seems so strange to me. For many centuries, they were just gathering dust. And then it was maybe like the 1600s, 1700s, they were kind of rediscovered, brought out and published. Maybe it was more like the time of publishing. And that popularized them. But both of these weren't studied by all the Soto Zen people from Dogen and Kazan onward. We don't know what they actually were studying, probably koan collections. But I thought that's interesting and strange history. So for those who weren't here this morning, today's story is our ancestor, Taiyo Kyogen Daiyosho, or Dayang Qin Shuren, the 43rd ancestor. And the story that Kazan's about to comment on is, once Dayang asked his teacher Liangshan, what is the signless sight of enlightenment? What is the signless place of awakening? And Liangshan pointed to a picture of Bodhisattva Guanyin and said, this was painted by scholar Wu. And Dayang was just about to speak when Liangshan suddenly grabbed him and said, this is what has sign. What is it that has no sign? And with these words, Dayang comprehended. So we're talking about how signs are the way we know things, the way we identify things. If anyone knows a little Chinese, the character called So looks like this. The character that's translated it to translate nimitta and lakshana, or sign. And I thought, it's nice that it's not a Buddhist character, but they use it to translate those Buddhist terms. And I think it's very nice for sign because this left radical, this left half of the character is tree, and this half is eye, like an eyeball. So it's like an eye looking at a tree. It's like we're perceiving a tree, and that's how we know that our eye interacting with an object, an ordinary object like a tree, could be anything, I think, is how we identify it. So the sign of something is like our sense organs and mind interacting with objects. The way our senses meet objects is they meet the sign of the object. So something about the way like an eye meets a tree or anything, I think is a nice pictorial summary of the meaning of this character sign. So the signless place of awakening is where the eye can't identify a tree as a tree anymore. So this is now Keizan's Teisho. I think these are actually talks that were transcribed, maybe in Sesshin. He says, the most essential thing in the study of Zen is this signless sight of awakening. It is not bound by form and has no name. Although it is therefore unrelated to words, it definitely turns out to be something clear. It is the meaning of, quote, your face before you were born, unquote. So it's not, it can't be pinned down in words like tree or a painting by Scholar Wu or book. But it is something clear. It's not related to words, but it does turn out to be something clear nevertheless. It is your face before you were born. Therefore, when he tried to indicate this realm, Liangshan pointed to a painting of Guan Yin that had been painted by Scholar Wu as if he were pointing to a mirror. This painting was painted by Scholar Wu. And maybe Dayan was about to say something. We don't know what he was about to say when he got cut off. But I imagine my fantasy is the first word he was about to say was, but. I don't know. But that's just a painting. That's just a form. That's the signs. How can you say that that's the signless place of awakening? How can you be talking about this, the signs of this object? But Keizan says that Liangshan pointed to this painting of Guan Yin as if he were pointing to a mirror. In other words, like, it's not this actual painting that we think it is by perceiving its signs. We're actually looking at a mirror when we see that painting, or we see that statue of Manjushri, or we see this book. This book was written by Keizan. We think, oh yeah, it's a book like this, all these signs, but actually, it's a mirror. It's a tree. It's a smiley face. No, it's light. So he pointed to it as if you were pointing to a mirror. This is what's meant by having eyes but not seeing, having ears but not hearing, having hands but not holding, having a mind but not discriminating, having a nose but not smelling, having a tongue but not tasting, having feet but not walking. It is as if none of the six faculties was being used, and the entire body became useless furniture. One is like a wooden figure or an iron person. That's such, like we talk about when the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. When the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up dancing. We chanted this morning, right, in a dual mirror samadhi. There's some dynamic dancing activity going on, but it's like it's dancing without dancing. It's like the dance of a wooden man that can't actually move. Actually, the wooden man's singing, right? A wooden man can't sing, and a stone woman actually can't dance. But when the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up to dance. And then that poem goes on. It can't be reached by feeling or discrimination. How could it admit of consideration in thought? So all these sayings are always pointing back towards the same thing. Not that nothing's happening here. It's not that, in this case, it is having eyes, but not seeing. It's having it like an eye that doesn't meet the tree. Knowing without touching things. One is like a wooden figure or an iron person. At such a time, seeing forms and hearing sounds quickly disappear. When Dayang started to speak at this point, Liangshan, in order to prevent him from saying something delusory, suddenly grabbed him and asked, "This is what has sign. What is it that has no sign?" So he was about to say, he's about to just engage in the world of signs of this painting. But that has the white robe of Guanyin, it has white and it has the blue water she's floating on. And Scholar Wu, I know him, he lives in the next town over. So, in order to prevent him from saying those delusory things, he just grabbed him and said, "This is what has sign." So, we can interpret various ways. I take that to mean like this, meaning like what the but that you're about to say, and all the things, everything you're about to say, before you even say it, I'm going to tell you that that's just what has signs, because speech is like that. Anything we say is like the words. Defining things and signing things. It's kind of the function of speech. This is a painting by Scholar Wu, or there's a tree. It's through words and language that we put signs on things. Can we do it without words and language? You can definitely do it without speaking out loud, by just looking at a tree and recognizing it as a tree. But that would be a question we can investigate in our experience, like when we're outside of Kinhin and we look up and see a tree and notice how quickly we know what it is. We think we know what it is. It's a tree. You can watch how your mind creates that tree and kind of names it. You can see if maybe it can do it without even the name tree. Like it's just something so familiar. We don't even need to name it a tree because it's so like we feel very comfortable with it because it's the same tree. that we always see in that location. We're so used to it, we don't even need to call it a tree. But if it was not there when we went out of Kinin, we might be surprised and feel uncomfortable. So that's why this morning I mentioned that Thich Nhat Hanh said, when we in the signless realm where we don't have signs or things, we feel anxiety. So it's very comfortable to kind of recognize all the stuff around us, kind of unconsciously even, I think, without even like, oh, there's a tree, there's a house, there's a car. But it's all in its place. I think we're still signing it. And it feels quite comfortable. If we looked around and we actually like, what is all this stuff? What's going on here? We start to feel anxiety. So I think there's maybe a kind of pre-verbal thing. But the verbal, it's, I think, aided by the words and language. And the words and language, I think, help to really solidify, to kind of paste that sign onto the thing. It's a painting by Scholar Wu. Now we can really name it. Now we really got it. But even before we name it, we kind of got it, I think. We can check out our experience. These subtleties of how we meet things. So to prevent Dayang from saying something delusory, maybe in parentheses you could say, from saying anything which would be delusory, he grabbed him and said, this, what you're about to say, and you, and my hand holding you, and the painting that's sitting next to us, all of this, everything we're thinking about, all of this has signs. Kind of like, you could say it was this two-part thing. First we bring up the painting. Very unusual, he's just signing something as soon as I ask about the signless place. And then it kind of maybe, that contrast maybe already started loosening up Dayang's mind around objects. So then he could heighten the tension by grabbing a hold of him immediately and saying, oh, this is sign. What is it right now in the midst of this? Kind of, maybe it's created a little bit of a confusing situation too. I thought we were talking about a painting. Why is he grabbing me? In the height, in the peak of this interaction, what is it now that has no sign? And you know, it worked. Seems like the combination of that whole interaction. Maybe they've been sitting along zazen for a long time already too, and. Dayang comprehended. He got Dayang to understand the faceless by means of something that has no function. It was like knowing who he was by looking into a clear mirror. And this is referring to the verse. After this awakening, Dayang has this verse in which he has the line, I had all this doubt until my teacher showed me the mirror of Qin. And so the commentary now says, there was a mirror long ago in the time of Emperor Qin. By looking into it, it seemed that all the body's internal organs, 84,000 pores and 360 bones could be seen. There's all these strange Chinese kind of folk tales. I googled this trying to find out more about the mirror of Qin, and there was nothing there, but there's all the stuff about how these Chinese emperors had these kind of magic mirrors that actually, that you could apparently see through metal as part of the magic. You could see like the back of the mirror. The back was all decorated. You could look into the front and you'd see the back. Various scientific explanations for how that works.
X-ray.
X-ray. Yeah. Yeah, something like something in the process of making the mirror, actually, with and the way that it was had these kind of hairline seams that couldn't be noticed normally, but when the light was shining on the mirror and it reflected on the wall, it would show up the impressions from the back. And I don't know about this mirror of Emperor Qin, where you look into it, yeah, it's like this is like an X-ray mirror. You look into it and you see all your bones and organs reflected. It's really an X-ray mirror. So maybe it's a metaphor for, when he says, my teacher showed me the mirror of Qin. It's like the mirror that showed me myself, my inner self that I can't usually see, like my bones. Maybe like a metaphor like that. It's a little strange. Even though you have ears and eyes, when you do not use them, you see what is not bound by body or mind. So, Sesshin practice, we have eyes and ears, and we don't turn them off, because we can't turn them off without earplugs and eye masks. So we leave our eyes open, and our ears open, and our nose open, and our tongue open, and our body open. But we could say we don't use them. We don't carry our sense organs forward and experience the myriad things. We let the myriad things come forth and use our senses, maybe we could say. And Sesshin, we just let them be without doing anything, but they're fully functioning. And we could call that, if we're really not intending to do anything with our eyes and ears, that's a little bit like dropping off the eyes and ears. Maybe like what's meant by having eyes but not seeing, having ears but not hearing. The usual way of seeing and hearing where we carry our eyes and ears forward to the sound and color. Not only do you break through the 1,000 mountains and 10,000 rivers of form or sign, you quickly break through the darkness of no mind and non-discrimination. Heaven and earth are no longer separated. None of the myriad forms sprouts, and everything is perfectly complete. So, this is fancy Zen talk for, I think, saying a kind of simple thing. Just let your body and mind just be. Everything open. And there's a tendency for the senses and the mind to get involved in all kinds of externals, but more and more just come to rest, to let go. All that stuff is still open. So therefore, we break through the 1,000 mountains and 10,000 rivers of signs, like we're no longer grasping at the signs of things. But we also immediately break through the darkness of no mind and non-discrimination. So it's not that it's not like we're shutting everything off. Like that kind of, I think that's the kind of no mind he's talking about here. It's not that like the mind goes dead. Now heaven and earth are no longer separate. The heaven of vast, spacious blackbirds singing in the dead of night, and the earth of white doves, the white album, the white album being played at 17 decibels of sound on an old Sony turntable with a scratch in the record at number 9. So, heaven and earth, I think we could see like the ultimate vastness where there's nothing to distinguish, and the world of distinctions and paintings painted by certain people, certain times, and certain albums and so on. They're no longer separate. Therefore, the signless place of awakening, we can say, where is it? This painting was painted by Scholar Wu. There's no contradiction there. It's right there in that painting. And those words, it's a tricky thing with words because, he said, this realm is unrelated to words, but is there a way, I hope there is, a way to use words freely without getting caught by them. I think that's part of the art of these long, wordy Zen expositions. It was not only Dayang who made Dongshan's tradition flourish all at once in this way. All the ancestors saw it the same way. After he understood this point, while he was at Dayang, so later, Dayang is teaching, and the monk asked, what is your family style? What's the style of your tradition? What's the wind of your house? This was often asked in these old Zen records. They're all practicing Zen, but what's your particular family style? Maybe Soto Zen, but maybe like just Dayang's way. How would you summarize your style? It's a nice question that would give a nice prompt for these teachers to recite a poetic statement to kind of like encapsulate their style. So Dayang said, regarding the style of his tradition, the brimming pitcher is turned upside down, but is not emptied, and there are no hungry people in all the world. So the brimming pitcher or container, completely filled to the brim, it's turned upside down, but nothing pours out of it. Yet, there are no famished or hungry people in the whole world. Again, these two sides. There's nothing is lost from this overflowing pitcher. So when it's poured out, nothing ever gets lost. There's nothing to lose and nothing to gain. And but then we might say, well, nothing pours out of it, how will the hungry people get fed? Nothing comes out of it, and yet the whole world is completely nourished and fed. Beautiful phrase, I think. Keizan says about that, truly, though you tip this realm over, it does not empty. Though you push on it, you cannot move it or open it. Though you try to lift it, you cannot pick it up. Though you touch it, there's nothing there. This realm, this mirror, you can't move it by pushing it, you can't lift it up, you can't touch it, there's nothing there. You cannot get it with your ears and eyes, and although it is accompanied by speech and silence, movement and stillness, it is not at all obstructed or hindered by movement and stillness. So this mirror can appear as a reflection of a painting by scholar Wu. But it's not hindered by that painting, because the painting doesn't stick to the mirror. It's not like the paint is actually like adhered to the surface of the mirror and you need like paint remover to get it off. It's completely manifest right there on the surface in great detail, in 3D sense around. But it doesn't touch the mirror at the same time. So again, although it's accompanied by speech, sometimes silence, movement, and sometimes stillness, it's not at all hindered or obstructed by movement or stillness. And it's not just Zen masters who possess this thing. There's not a single person in the whole world who doesn't have it. Therefore, Dayang said, there are no famished people. Of course, who wouldn't have such a mirror? But not so many people appreciate the mirror because the reflections are so enticing and so real-looking. The mirror is very, very shiny and clear. If it were a little dull, we could say, oh, that's just a reflection on there. But the mirror is so clear. It comes that way. Even if we have glasses, or if we're not wearing glasses, it might look blurry, but the... But it's very clear. It's so difficult to see all of this as a reflection. Especially when the reflections start poking at our soft spots. So that's why Sashin might poke at our soft spots quite a bit, actually. But we try to set it up so that it's like a really, we take care of everything and everyone so that we're like flowing in harmony. We're not disturbing each other too much. A little bit. You can maybe find a lot of disturbance even when we're not disturbing each other, right? But we try to create not so much poking, because when there's a lot of poking going on, then it's just like, forget the mirror. We just gotta like deal with these nasty reflections. But if there's a little less, if we start to just relax and we're not being bombarded by the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, then maybe there's a chance to look again. Is it really how it appears? Is it really what I think it is here? Or is it all a reflection in this vast mirror with no boundaries? There are no famished people. But maybe Yang Shan would grab me as soon as I say, but if he were here. But since he's not, I can say, but you can grab me if you want. Tell me to stop. But even though there are no famished people. Many people feel as if they're famished. I myself often feel at least a little hungry. Something's a little missing. Sometimes I might remember there's really nothing lacking, but often I forget. I just don't appreciate the fact that there are no famished people, especially me. Everybody else might be not famished, but I actually feel a little hungry. Everybody else seems to be doing fine. Why am I so hungry? So there are no famished people, but it's hard to appreciate that. So that's why we have Sesshin. Zen worthies, you have fortunately become descendants in Dongshan's family and have encountered the family style of awakened predecessors. If you practice precisely and carefully, and since this is the practice instruction, I had to look up another translation there. It says, if you investigate exhaustively and continuously, if you practice precisely and carefully, if you investigate exhaustively and continuously and are personally awakened to the time prior to birth and the arising of form and emptiness, reach the realm where there's not a fragment of sign or description. Experience the realm where there's not the least atom of external stuff. I like that. There's not the least, you know, as reflections in the mirror. We are the mirror, so there's not an atom of external stuff apart from this mirror mind. You will not find the four great elements and five skandhas, the five aggregates, in countless eons. Or Thomas Kalari summarized that as, you will not find your body and mind. The technical way of saying that is, the four great elements of the body and the five aggregates of mind in countless eons. If you can clarify that which is never missing, even for a second, then you're really a descendant of Dongshan's family and one of Qing Yuan's offshoots. Qing Yuan is like this much earlier ancestor. Kind of, I don't know why. It's when it's the beginning of the Soto branch from the sixth ancestor. You have any clarifying questions or expressions? Because words can't hinder this realm.
So this is kind of the realm where the one hand is clapping? I was wondering about that.
What is the sound of one hand? That looked like two. Yeah, it's just how it appears. Yeah. What is the sound of one hand? What was? What is our original face before our parents were born? Yes. So many layers, or at least it appears like many layers. Seems what? Eons away.
Mm-hmm.
And it can seem so complicated if we say there's, you know, all the layers of profundity. And sometimes we can talk about layers of profundity, like we had this class on the Dzogchen's five permutations that almost seem like layers of profundity. And yet at the same time, any way we relate to all those layers is like conceptual constructs. So apart from the conceptual constructs that put signs on the different layers and so on, there's, I think this realm, when he talks about this realm, is like a total simplicity. It's just when we're just letting go in the moment without holding on to anything. Well, we can't actually maybe talk about it so clearly then, but there's nothing lacking and nothing extra. It's very simple, right, at the same time. So even to say, well, it seems eons away or to reach this realm of the ancestors seems so remote and steep. And I agree, it often does sound that way. And at the same time, I think we could say that's the kind of the fact that, you know, eons away and, all kinds of stages of practice and so on are all just more conceptual constructs. So there's something that actually is perfectly complete from the beginning, like the mirror that never comes and goes and is never tarnished or dull. All people in the world are actually never famished, are never hungry. And yet you could say maybe, practically speaking, it takes a long time to fully appreciate that in all kinds of situations. So again, both sides. Eons away and always imminent right here, perfectly complete. We don't want to get stuck in either side. If we get stuck in the perfectly complete, then we maybe get a kind of like lazy and complacent. And if we don't want to get stuck in the, it's so far away and, I'm so dull and have such a small capacity compared to these ancestors, then we get dragged down in that perspective too. Yes.
It reminds me of a poem by Hoffmannsthal. It's said in German and translated. It goes, "Einst waren alle Tiefen stumm und alle Wurzeln krumm." This is like talking about pre-existence before there was language. Once everyone was deep and dumb, and then speechless. When alle Wurzeln krumm, and everyone knew about it. Nun gave us Bauchhebel. Now the word goes around, oh, niemand weiß on, and no one knows why. It's like contrasting the two. We need both, actually, the words and pre-existence. Being really in touch.
Yep. Yeah, we need both.
But if we grasp onto the words, we've lost it.
If we grasp onto the words, we've lost it, and if we grasp onto empty non-doing, we've lost it too. We've lost our skillful, compassionate response in the world. Yes?
Sometimes when I have to leave here in the morning before service, and I have to go to work, and just about the time that, you know, I've got my robes off and I'm leaving, the group in here is in the middle of the chant, and I'm aware that I'm listening and I'm doing the discriminating, trip, and but I can also remember when I'm in the system, when I'm here, I'm not exactly, you know, even though I'm not in a trance while I'm doing the service here, even though I'm aware of my surroundings, I'm not using that discriminative mind, the best way to say
that. Yeah, discriminating mind.
Discriminating mind. So, I've got my ears and my eyes and my nose, just as it was saying there, but I'm not using them in the way that when I'm standing out there hearing, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, I can say, oh,
interesting. When you're a little bit outside or removed in this, you know, in this example, then discrimination kicks in. And the more intimate we are with the actual situation, we're just immersed in what we're doing, there's less so. That's why what's the business beneath the patched robe is intimacy. Just enacting the activity. And that's a nice example that you bring up, because Sesshin, I think it's part of the beauty of like the structure of Sesshin. We have all these kind of ritualized ways of doing things. And it's hard at first when it all seems new, it seems that we feel separate from it a little bit. But the more we get used to it, and so even if it seems new, if you're just sitting here through the day, it starts to become more familiar. And then these activities start to become more like the flow. I think of like Orioki meals, how we do, right? There's this great way where maybe we're on the first day today, so we're kind of remembering how it works, how we get served and serving and so on. And as we get more familiar with it there's that sense of like the server comes and we just meet. And in the silent interaction, it's a little bit like the wooden man singing and the stone woman gets up dancing. And these, you know, we bow to get, and you know, it's, I think, I don't know if the forms evolved from this kind of understanding, or if any form would feel that way if you're sitting a lot of zazen with it. But I think things like how we, you know, we meet and bow together, it's like this unified moment. Of, you know, we don't really have to think about it. And the more we get used to it, the more we're just embodying it. I think it's the beauty of this kind of practice. It just offers so many of these opportunities. Yeah.
To have it all folded in on itself so that the experience itself, rather, everything dissolves into that experience.
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it. Mm-hmm. All our thoughts and discriminations about it all dissolve into the actual activity itself. So sometimes, you know, it's to make it even a little bit more complicated. Sometimes works even better, because it's kind of like once you get used to the simpler things, then that adds and like you have to be paying attention. Like as Doan, people who do the Doan for service, ring the bells, you maybe notice that, how like you really have to just be there with each bell. And if you start thinking about something else, even like get distracted by the other parts of service, like the doshi does something differently, and then I can throw the doan off, like, wait a second. But you have to just catch where you're at and just keep going. So, dissolve into it.
I had a little difficulty dissolving into so many words during the service, but I'm trusting that will.
Yeah, especially all those names of ancestors. Long lists of names, when it's kind of like, you know, the poems are maybe a little bit easier, but morning service, in Sesshin, we do the long version. So maybe it just offers the challenge. I feel a little challenged by it myself. Like, really? This is the majority of the chanting is these lists of names. But I feel like, especially this Denko A Sesshin, we're kind of celebrating the lineage of ancestors. So this one especially, I feel like, it's really, let's just bring up their names. I think Dogen even says, how do you, you know, what's the practice with these ancestors? I think at some point he says something like, bringing up their names and honoring them. So that's one thing we do, that we can surrender to. Get into like the rhythm of it. Like the locomotive. Sometimes it feels like that when we're in the groove. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I think we could say the whole point of doing this kind of practice and especially like a more intensive retreat like this is not just in and of itself. I mean, we could look at it that way too, just to do it with no future results in mind. But in fact, I think we do it because we do want to bring a deeper appreciation of this realm into like, you know, all our ordinary activities. And it does, yeah, the effects actually do happen, yeah. And we do change in often ways that aren't even perceivable to ourselves. But then we're just reading the paper one day and it just seems like the flow, or like the paper's reading us. So, yeah. That's why it takes so much patience, I think, this practice, because it doesn't give like, you do this sesshin and then the next day you'll just be at one with everyone at work. It's not necessarily like, you know, so immediate. Sometimes it might be, but over a long time, subtly, it seems to percolate into our experience. And it's also quite humbling how sometimes it doesn't. So we just continue. Yeah. Thanks for that story. Yeah. Another example of how, you know, it's everywhere. It's definitely not limited to in the Zendo and any particular tradition. Everyone in the world, there are no famished people anywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything is just fully released, but nothing's lost. And there's no famished people in the whole world. That's an interesting relationship, too, of like, he's saying, you know, this is my family style. The brimming container is turned upside down. Not necessarily my brimming container, but the vast brimming container that covers the whole world and is never emptied. And yet, nobody goes hungry. Kazan closes this talk by saying, "Now, how can I convey this principle briefly? Would you like to hear?" His verse. "The perfect mirror hangs high and reflects everything clearly. The vermilion boat is so beautiful that no painting can do it justice." Relaxing. Into the moment. No past and future. Nothing to do. Nowhere to go. May all beings be equally nourished. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.